weaving a path through hopeful melancholy, nuanced vulnerabilities, and jarring juxtapositions, Alexander Biggs' debut album is a beautifully constructed observation of life around us, from the sad to the happy, the lost to the found, from distant to close, from love to hate. Hit or miss hits you hard. The warm voice of Alexander Biggs will take you for a ride that you want to stay on and then rewind and start again. We have Alexander Biggs with us to share this amazing debut with us on the Tuck Shop. G'day, Alexander.
Hello.
G'day.
Thank you. That was lovely.
Thanks so much for joining us
like
on the
my
Tuck
eulogy.
Shop.
Eulogy.
I feel like, you know, this album is just, that word I was trying to say at the top, juxtapositions. I feel like that's such a perfect description of this album because you balance the lows and the highs, the hits and the misses throughout this record. Very poignant, don't you think?
I try. I hope I have. Everyone likes a little bit of light and shade.
I think so. And that duality is just ever present in life, right? We all live it day to day. We have our highs, we have our lows. And you can't have one without the other. Does this sort of mentality sort of represent what your head's like? You know, how do you feel? And do you sort of feel those emotions very heavily, the highs and the lows?
I think we all do. And I know for one, I definitely have my fair share of going between the two. Have my fair share of dark days and my fair share of good days. I mean, now more than ever, I think, and I kind of like experiencing life in that way and taking it all in. And some days I'm just so ecstatic and other days I'm maybe being more of a doomer.
Well, we all have our days. let's go back to the beginning. Let's tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, where you grew up and where your first musical spark happened. What's the Alexander Biggs story?
Okay. Well, I grew up in a place called Mildura, which is on the Murray River up the northwest of Victoria. Mm. And, you know, first musical spark, I don't know. I mean, like the boring story is, my sister was playing piano when I was a kid and I wanted to do that. So then I just did that. And that was probably the first musical spark. Mm. But as far as songwriting goes, I didn't really experience like a real knowingness of songs until I was 21 or something.
Yeah.
I was really into hardcore as a teen and I was programming breakdowns into Guitar Pro, if anyone knows what that is.
Oh, Guitar Pro. Wow.
But yeah. I was really into that kind of thing and just like making songs that are MIDI and then giving it to my friends and then we'd jam out and blow our ears out. But yeah, I didn't find a knowingness for songs until I really found like Elliott Smith, I think, in uni.
Yeah, right. And obviously it feels like there's a strong influence from Elliott Smith's sort of music in there. Maybe not so much My Chemical Romance or Paramore, which I believe you're a big fan of.
Yeah, I'm pretty into the, well, I was. I still rate those records and, I don't listen to it anymore, but I'll happily, take a trip down memory lane and put the record on. And I think they're still incredible songs. But maybe I'm less angsty in that sense and more angsty in a more mature sense.
Well, I think no matter what, even that hardcore sort of punk scene back in, I guess we're talking early 2000s, late 90s, you know, it does evoke emotion. You know, it's got that sort of real, teenage angst feel. And we all went through that.
It's a lot. I mean, one of the biggest things that I think was integral in writing the songs I do now was really killing that idea of music that I had prior. Yeah. I'm really sorry to any new punk bands out there, but I can understand it maybe, but like I'm a bit of a Grinch here because I was doing it too, but it just feels so fake and so false and just so like, and especially in like those early 2000s, man, like all those lyrics were just fucking women hating lyrics. Like it's really misogynist. If you look at some of those bands, like it's always some girl, and even like bands will be like murdering this like made up woman, and it's just, it's fucked. It's truly fucked. And also just like, I don't know, it's not real. I'm going on a rant now, but it just feels like, it just feels like that stuff is not, the pain is all fake. It's also fake, and it's also glossed over, and the production value, I don't know, it has no heart, like the early, like Midwest emo, or like a band like American Football or something. There's heart there, you know, but then it's all about like, it's just ultra violence and ultra sadness. And
yeah, it was all about extremes, wasn't it? Extreme emotions, you know, and almost trying to elicit responses from the way, or the lyrics that they'd use, you know, to try and get a reaction. I wasn't a big fan of those bands, to be honest, but I was interested in how you were, because, you know, obviously you've matured in what you listen to nowadays.
I look at 90% of that and it's just all way too edgy, you know, it's so try hard, you know, like it's not finding any like redeeming value, or it doesn't know itself, it's not aware of itself, I think in any way, and it, you can tell it lacks awareness, because if they're aware of what they're doing, they'd quit.
What do you listen to nowadays? You know, what's your favorite new artist?
It's all shit. It's all bad. I don't have good music taste. Maybe that's my awareness here, is like no one has good music taste. I've been listening to a bit of everything. Can I get my Spotify up and actually do this? I've actually been really enjoying Bill Callahan lately, which I'm kind of new to. I'm kind of blessed with not knowing anything about music. I found that to be, at first I kind of beat myself up and thought it was a shortcoming, but I really enjoy visiting records that everyone listened to in high school that I was not aware of, and now I can appreciate it more and really delve in and put my song hat on if I wanna.
I agree. You know, there's no time limit to when you can discover an artist or go back and listen to them. So there's always
And I was like 23 when I started listening to Velvet Underground, and I love them. I love them so much, and I'm so glad that I first heard them, well, like consciously, when I was 23, because if I heard them when I was in my big old hardcore phase, I probably would have hated them. I'd probably been like, oh, their instruments aren't even in tune, like, you know. Anyway, Bill Callahan's been really neat to listen to, and I like his new record, Gold Record.
We love playing him to OCR, but it's one of those artists that, you know, I got onto late as well, so yeah, I can totally feel what you're saying there.
Oh, he has a real knowingness there, you know, and I really like Stella Donnelly. I've been visiting that debut she put out, which I really love. And an artist called Kate Davis, who just did a Daniel Johnston cover record.
Amazing. Geez, you know, I was just thinking, Stella Donnelly, I could see you doing a duet with Stella Donnelly. I feel like your voices would...
Stella Donnelly is amazing. And I'm such a fan, and I truly think that, I mean, she got a lot of acclaim, I guess, with that record, but not enough. I think it was still underrated.
Yep.
For what she was really dishing out. But yeah, I played a couple shows with her and Alex the Astronaut once, and they're both lovely.
Amazing. Yeah, I feel like she has this ability, and maybe you do too. I haven't seen you live yet, but she has really sad songs, but then in between the tracks, she'll lighten it up, she'll brighten the room with a smile, and then all of a sudden you feel, you know, you don't know how to feel, because you had this music that's made you feel one way, and then she's just smiling and joking and swearing in between the songs, and I was always like, oh, this is amazing.
I like Cheeky. Yeah. Cheeky's like my favorite of any of the moods, I'm going to say. It's the top one. It's like on Maslow's hierarchy of moods, Cheeky is ultimate. But I like Beware of the Dogs, like the song I've been enjoying the most. And I love how there's that comment on being cautious of politicians, but at the same time, she's just kind of calling politicians dogs, which I thought is particularly cheeky. And just a great, what's the word? Like there's a cool double entendre there.
Yeah. I love that you've picked up that, but I think I look at your lyrics and they're quite dark at times, but you also always speak of a positive, there's always a yearning, there's love in there. And even when you feel like they're getting really dark, I'd always found comfort in your songs. In this album, I've been walking along the streets listening to your music, and I always feel a calmness. I'm just looking around, you know, looking at nature. I just really feel calm listening to your record, even though it's quite sad in parts. It must be exciting to sort of get the different reactions from people and how they feel about your record. You wouldn't have any expectations when you go into it, I guess, but how do you feel about how it makes people feel?
I think it is neat. I'm glad that you walk with it, because I mean, my big inspirations for music are all albums I like to take for walks and really and lose myself in them, walking around the neighborhood. And so it's kind of neat. And I always make my recordings with, you know, headphone listening in mind.
Snakes coil in the radiator, hissing out their heat. Crawled out to the pavement, scrape my knees on the concrete. And if I said it like I mean it, if I start to act my age, I would feed myself on fireworks and
I don't know. It's neat. I'm glad that it's cool hearing people's reactions, and you can only ever prepare yourself for them to find so much more in it than you had intended. And thankfully, that's happened.
I think it's the wonder of art, isn't it? I mean, people interpret art in all different ways. And so as an artist yourself, I suppose you can't lock in a feeling to say this is how you must feel when you listen to or see.
Yeah, it's not mine anymore. Once it comes out into the world, it's not mine. And so it's a great handshake, a good handing over of the baton. You know, I just pass it on and now it's everyone else's.
I also read, after I've been walking to your album, that you walked around Manhattan listening to All I Know, which you made with Wilson, and just had it on repeat.
Yeah, it really moved me. It was my first time in New York, and that co-write was 2 days worth. And the first day we did absolutely nothing. Well, we didn't do nothing. We were just like umming and ahhing and not really knowing. We'd only just met that day, and then we went away, and I was like, oh man, we really got to get something. And then nothing was happening. And then we came back from lunch and just smashed it out in like a couple of hours.
You're all I know. A speck of dust in the soft glow.
And then, I don't know, we did it. We did the mixing. Garage band.
Yeah, right.
And there's so much static. This is a demo. I might have to put that up at a point, but it's still kind of the same arrangement, to be honest. I added a synth after the fact.
I just
took the train over to Manhattan and walked around, and I just walked for k's and k's. It was and taking it all in, and I just couldn't get enough of the song. And I just at that stage, it didn't even feel like something I'd done. It just felt like a mood that a thing I'd been feeling had just manifested itself in the most whole way. And so it was kind of nice to accompany that big old walk. Such a huge place.
No choice at all.
You were in the US at the start of 2020, I believe, so gearing up for South by Southwest. Of course, that was all thrown into chaos and you know, nothing happened. But how did that turmoil sort of change the trajectory of the album?
It's a good question. I was going there to play South by and stay over for a whole bunch and play a bunch of shows and meet a lot of people and et cetera. But I don't know, I came home and I think not to make light of it, but I found a silver lining in having a bit more time to just finesse a record. And there were some extra songs that I wanted to kind of work on. And I don't know. I just made the most of it.
Was it going to come out last year?
Tentatively, we were working, my manager and I were working towards that. But it was more so just giving the singles more time to breathe and like kind of working on art and things like that, that we decided to extend it into 2021. Not that I was, I mean, it sounds like I'm trying to be all prideful, like I'm not scared of the lockdown, but it wasn't out of like an aversion to like releasing songs in 2020. If anything, my approach was like, now's a more better time than ever to put a record out. Like, I mean, people are spending more time looking for some kind of like media to get through the days. Like, why not? But it just kind of worked out that Feb was better, because obviously you can't do December. No. Anyone in the industry listening knows that shit. You can't put it out in December or Jan. So
yeah, there's these like lockout times where you can't release music because there's too many other things.
Yeah, everyone's on holiday. That's fine. I'd be sick of me too.
All right, we want to play a track here on the Tuck Shop from the album. And we've played it before, but I really wanted to play it again because it's the first song on the record. It's called Low. What can you tell us about this track?
Low is about feeling really low.
Yeah. And it's and some really poetic lyrics in there, or as they are all through the record. Have a listen to these words. Don't get too sad, but just soak them in. We're talking to Alexander Biggs here on the Tuck Shop. This is Low.
Ainsley chirps like a bird, howls when she's hurt, speaks to me stern, teaches me words, thrives in the dirt, spills her red wine, ruins my shirts, bloodies my nose, lips like a rose, somewhere to go. When I'm
on the Tuck Shop here on 2SER. My name is Mick. You just heard from his amazing debut record, Alexander Biggs and Low. The album's called Hit or Miss, and we're very lucky to have Alexander on the phone right now, or on a Zoom, one of those technologies. Hey, Alexander, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the old microphone.
I must say, you're sounding very clear as well. It's one of the benefits of all this lockdown, as we're using better technology now rather than phones.
Yeah, I finally caved and got a SM7B for all those podcasters out there. Nice. Or radio folk. That's kind of nice. I've done a couple of interviews on like small diaphragm condensers, which were kind of neat, but then you just get a lot of the room, so feel like this makes my voice sound deeper and more authoritative.
It does. I feel, you know, challenged with my voice, which I feel like is quite deep and authoritative. Speaking of like microphones and recording and things like that, I believe you recorded this album in a variety of locations other than a studio. Whereabouts did you go?
Where did I go?
Where did you record?
Well, I recorded everywhere. I recorded in my my room in Thornbury in Melbourne, and in the kitchen in Thornbury, and in the city, and in cubbies, like little blanket forts.
Yeah.
And I recorded in the lounge room of the Grove Studios on the Central Coast. I actually recorded some guitars. Now, I'm just remembering this. In my dad's office in Arizona.
Wow.
Where I was sleeping on like a blow up mattress, and I just recorded it straight onto my MacBook, like the MacBook speakers.
That's amazing. And that got onto the record.
Yeah, it did. It's the guitars at the end.
Oh, wow.
I forget what they're doing. They're doing something. They're in there.
I heard that you sort of
been everywhere.
You prefer sort of places that aren't your traditional studio. I think it's funny that you did it in the lounge room of the Grove Studios rather than in one of the studios.
Yeah, I was privileged enough to get a room there while a writing camp was happening. And I was just there on the basis of like, hey, here's a spare room that we're kind of like, we've got the place anyway, so come and like do some recording for the record. And then I ended up writing with my friend Will, who has a project called Lanx, and Sam, who has a project called Sam Fay. Yeah. And we wrote the song I've Been Holding On To You for Way Too Long, and then they went to bed and I recorded Macaroni Necklace and wrote it. I wrote and recorded Macaroni.
Oh, by yourself, just in that night?
Yeah. My voice was a bit shot, so the original vocals were pretty fucked up. And though it was going to make it that way, but I chickened out last minute.
I love hearing the stories of how these songs are made. But when I look at the lyrics and I look at the poetic thoughts and the personal stories that have gone into some of these songs, you know, I wonder what sort of headspace you were in when you wrote them. And obviously you form an intimacy with your music, especially when you're recording it, hearing it over and over again. Did you retain that intimacy even through the making of the record, when you sort of obviously feel a connection to all these songs and you've probably heard them a billion times each, but do you still feel what you felt when you wrote them?
Maybe not. Yeah, I mean, it's just transformed. The feeling has transformed. So it's more like now when I listen, it's more a timestamp and it's more an homage to that feeling. Whereas when I'm recording it, hell yeah. And even if recording takes a while and a few goes in different versions, I'm still definitely feeling it.
Great.
And I think that's the power of songs. You can just kind of channel that. Even if you play a cover, you can really feel what the writer had in mind. And I guess it's even a little easier if you're the writer yourself when you're doing it. But yeah, listening to it now, it's just kind of like, oh yeah, I remember that. And it's kind of nice. It's like growing up. It's like a physical marker to look back at and go like, well, I felt this way. Now things aren't so dire, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever way you can see an obvious progression in yourself.
I think it's great. I'm always jealous of a musician who can create music over time, and it's like a diary, a journal of their life via the music that's created.
That's one of my favorite parts is having just a big collection of songs.
Yeah. I love that you still feel that connection, because, I mean, I can't wait to see these performed live, and I feel, you know, musicians who still have that connection to the songs they make and aren't sick of them is important, because, you know,
miles may vary. Yeah.
But we all want to listen to them over and over again as well, and we'll still feel it. So I'm glad that you did too.
Yeah, I think there's a real obligation as a performer to play those songs, you know, do it like you mean it, because you might be a little sick of them, but other people haven't played them all day, every day for years. So you owe them. They've come, they've paid, you owe them, you know, the sentiment.
speaking of live music, how much have you had a chance to perform these songs yet to an audience?
You know, once Melbourne kind of got back to allowing shows in some capacity, I've only played two so far, and I just immediately jumped into new music. So like I played like maybe three songs off the record, and then just all new songs, which was a bit rude, but I don't know anyone anything.
No, you don't. And that's yeah. That's exciting as well to hear new stuff.
That's it. But I'd like to get the record going either in like a back to front kind of thing, or like just mix it up and weave in a couple of newies.
Yeah.
There's no rush. I mean, like particularly with COVID and stuff, I mean, I don't feel compelled to hit the stage as soon as I can.
Congrats on the album. Really, really enjoying it. Here at 2SER, we'll be playing it a lot more over the coming weeks. We're going to take out this interview with the final track from the album. So I've gone for the first song earlier. Now we're going to go to the last song, which is the title track from the album, Hit or Miss. This is a bit of an older song, isn't it?
Yeah, this one was maybe in the middle of everything being made. And it originally was just going to be worked on because I felt like it didn't really make a lot of sense. But I feel like somewhere in there I sewed in the sentiment, so I just left it. And now it's really dear to me and it means a lot.
Oh, it must have melted a lot because it became the title of the album. Was it really just a no-brainer in the end, or how did you land on this track being the title track?
I didn't know what to call the record, and so I wrote out a whole lot of it. I'm not really good at naming the collective works. There's a lot of pressure there, but I eventually just settled. Well, I didn't settle, actually. I just wrote a whole bunch out, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And then I was like, of course it's got to be Hit or Miss. That sums up the whole record. Like, it was right in front of me, but it was never the intention to name the record that until like the very last moment. And I was like,
perfect.
It just worked. It really was true to what the record was in a way that I didn't intend.
Yeah, I agree. Really a nice way to finish out the record, Hit or Miss. Alexander Biggs, thank you so much for chatting to us on The Duck Show.
Sure. Yeah, awesome. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Spin me around the whole car park. My eyes tight shut in a shopping cart. Take it real slow and then far. I am overused, but still so in love. Is it all we did? Was just hit or miss? Is it all we did? Was just morning came slow.